why not accept this challenge and use this $28 million to fund renewable energy projects and not give it to other states?
Conservation groups criticize Governor Palin's decision on stimulus funding. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 29th of April. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a Juneau church rebuilds after a devastating fire.
A lot of the spaces in the old building were sort of dark and a little medieval, and this is bright and spacious.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
Renewable energy proponents are upset with Governor Sarah Palin's decision to reject more than $28 million in energy money under the federal stimulus plan. Governor Palin has stated that she believes the money under the state energy program will require a uniform energy code across Alaska. Karen Rehfeld, the director of the state's Office of Management and Budget, says the administration is concerned about a requirement that calls for a 90% compliance to a statewide energy code within 8 years. Rehfeld does acknowledge there is broad interest in the state in making sure buildings are constructed to energy standards.
But again, it's the idea that the state, at the state level, we would be directing, mandating, implementing, and enforcing, basically growing government in order to make that happen at the state level. And the governor firmly believes that those things should happen locally. I think through some of these statewide initiatives and efforts, you're going to see some general broad standards, but they're not going to be mandated at the state level.
Alaska Conservation Alliance Executive Director Kate Troll says Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Ketchikan already have energy codes for new construction, as does the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. She says the majority of the state is already meeting the requirement, and it should not be burdensome for rural unincorporated areas.
There's no problem for us exempting small communities less than 2,500, making sure it doesn't apply to cabins or remote homes. This is not a one-size-fits-all approach. This is establishing a minimum floor and assuring that 90% of the new and renovated buildings built in Alaska will meet this minimum energy requirement. And it's based on buildings and square footage. And, you know, when you've got our major municipalities like Anchorage and Fairbanks already stepping up to the plate, it's hard to understand where the objection is.
Assuming Governor Palin vetoes the funds, the legislature could override it. The deadline for a decision is May 12th. The cruise ship company Holland America announced this week plans to reduce the number of port calls in Haines next year. This is the third company to report reductions in the number of cruise ships coming to Alaska in 2010. From member station KHNS, John Hunt reports.
The decision to reposition the vessel to another part of the world means a number of port cities in Alaska will be losing visitors. This year, the Rhine-Dom is scheduled to stop in Ketchikan, Haines, Juneau, and Sitka before visiting the Hubbard Glacier and then dropping the majority of its passengers in Seward. The company's move means a reduction of 9 port calls next year, and it's making Haines excursion owners cringe. Bart Henderson is the owner of Chilkat Guides, a river rafting and adventure company that has been in business for more than 3 decades. Henderson has spent years crunching visitor numbers and has recently taken up the mantra for Haines to set a goal of attracting 4 cruise ships each week. He figures 4 is the minimum number of large ships that provides business owners the level of confidence to hire staff at a living wage for the entire season.
Everyone has managed to build their businesses up to a point where we have enough infrastructure in Haines to be able to accommodate the larger cruise ships in town. That's become a very vital part of the economy of Haines. You know, we're going into a scary time as to how much of that infrastructure, you know, how big can that infrastructure remain.
Last month, the Haines Tourism Advisory Board requested, and the Assembly later approved, a resolution inviting cruise lines to reconsider Haines as a port of call. The Tourism Department's unofficial slogan is, Haines, everything you dreamed Alaska would be. But the loss of the Rheindom is the opposite of what he's been hoping for, and it's forcing Henderson to look at cutbacks in his own staff.
We're just taking this year as it comes. It's a lot of people are predicting that numbers are going to be way down, and we're just going to hope for the best and see how this turns out. But it's going to be a tough season for everyone, for sure.
Henderson has seen tourism in the area flourish and falter. He started the business with just a handful of river guides. Some locals scoffed at the idea of taking visitors down the Chilkat River in rubber rafts. But in 2008, in their 30th year, the company employed over 100 people. Henderson says that number will be dropping to about 95 workers already this year. He says the cruise ship initiative passed in 2006 was another sign that Alaska isn't welcoming cruisers.
There's a lot of feeling in the cruise industry that Alaska is becoming a very difficult state to do business in. And I think that's a very dangerous thing, and I think that it's not only dangerous for the state, it's very dangerous for Haines. I mean, because we're on the outskirts, so we're on the edge of the business. When the business contracts, we're the first ones to fall off the edge.
The notion that the cruise initiative has hurt the state was given more credence this week. Mickey Arison, chairman of Carnival Corporation, which owns Holland America, Princess, and Carnival Cruises, was quoted by industry magazine Travel Trade, telling a group of financial analysts that Alaska cruise growth stopped immediately after the initiative was passed. Arison reportedly said the $50 head tax is hurting Alaska cruise sales. Reporting in Haines, I'm John Hunt.
Senator Lisa Murkowski joined with congressional colleagues from Washington State today to announce a new bill that would increase federal funding for the nation's ferry systems. The U.S. Ferry Systems Investment Act calls for $200 million a year for marine highways around the country. That would triple the current level of $67 million annually. Half the money would be allocated based on passenger and vehicle boardings and total ferry system route miles. The other $100 million would be distributed on a discretionary basis and help expand and start new ferry services. Senator Murkowski says it's too soon to know how much money would go to Alaska, but she's optimistic the state's 3,000 miles of ferry system would warrant a significant chunk of the funding.
With the formula the way it's structured, and a dedicated 25% to go towards the route miles, that helps a state like Alaska enormously. So we're optimistic that this will be a real boost for the Alaska Marine Highway System.
Murkowski says she doesn't expect the funds would be used to start new routes in Alaska. Instead, she says it could help with the Alaska Class Ferry Project, which aims to replace some of the aging vessels in the Southeast and Prince William Sound fleets.
Of the 11 vessels that we have, four of them are over 45 years old, which is, it's time to be looking at those as assets and how well they're functioning. So these dollars don't necessarily go towards operation, but they do go for maintenance and they do go for replacement.
Murkowski's co-sponsoring the bill with a colleague from across the aisle, Democratic Senator Patty Murray of Washington State. Murray says they're likely to move the ferry bill within a larger comprehensive transportation bill later this year instead of on its own.
It isn't always easy to convince some of our colleagues back in this Washington about the importance of a robust ferry system. They get the investments in roads and highways and in rail, but a lot of them don't realize that for many of our states, ferries are a very crucial link in the transportation chain.
Alaska Republican Congressman Don Young will support the bill in the House, and Democratic Senator Mark Begich's office says he hopes to sign on as a co-sponsor. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, scientists investigate a large-scale die-off of an unpopular plant.
Some of the researchers that we're working with at University of Alaska Fairbanks have considered this unprecedented, this amount of dieback in our thin-leafed alder.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP Alaska. BP is focused on the future, getting more oil out of Prudhoe Bay and bringing Alaska's gas to North America.
An ice jam on the Tanana River is causing flooding in the Salcha area south of Fairbanks. National Weather Service hydrologist Ed Plum says the river has topped its banks in an area along the old Richardson Highway. The highway and some homes have been affected. Plum says an overflight of the river shows the potential for continued trouble.
the ice jam is still there, and there's still plenty of ice upriver of the ice jam, including the Salcha River has not gone out yet either. So there's an abundant amount of ice still to come down that could back up behind the ice jam and cause the flooding to get worse.
The section of Tanana at Salcha is a problem spot where ice regularly jams and causes flooding. Plum says the current flooding situation is being compounded by this week's sudden warm-up that's caused rapid melting of the snowpack in area hills as well as the Alaska Range, sending a lot of water into rivers. A flood warning issued by the National Weather Service on Tuesday has been extended. Salcha Rescue and Fairbanks North Star Borough are coordinating assistance efforts for affected residents. Sandbags are being made available at the Salcha Fairgrounds. Eastern interior temperatures are in record territory, with highs climbing into the 70s in some areas of the Tanana Valley. National Weather Service meteorologist Jim Brader says a strong high-pressure system will keep it warm for at least a few more days.
What we call, in weather terms, a large blocking high that has developed over the north and eastern portion of Alaska, and that's going to last into Saturday, possibly longer, but we're looking for real warm temperatures over the interior and even on the north slope into Saturday.
Brader says high temperatures will continue to range into the 70s, with the warmest readings from Fairbanks to Tok. Walk past Juneau's Church of the Holy Trinity and you smell fresh-cut cedar. 3 years ago, the scent of charred ruins lingered in the air weeks after the March 12, 2006 fire that destroyed the building. The church was on the National Register of Historic Places when it burned. Juneau Episcopalians had worshipped in the sanctuary for 110 years. For more than 50 years, the adjoining hall was the site of everything from potlucks to jam sessions and Shakespeare for the entire city. Now the new building is enclosed, but several $100,000 must yet be raised before the sanctuary can open. KTOO's Rosemary Alexander recently took a tour of the new Holy Trinity.
We had dreamed of June and July, and we can still dream that way.
The Reverend Gerard Solides may sound like an optimist.
The more money we raise, the sooner we raise it, the sooner we can have occupancy. And so that's why I have the pessimistic view of the later fall.
Solides believes the congregation will be worshiping in the sanctuary by October. That's about $200,000 away. The rich smell of red cedar, milled in Huna, permeates the entryway and the sanctuary. That's where we begin our tour.
What you can't see on radio, but that we're enjoying here as we talk, is uplighting against the beautiful golden hues of the Douglas fir roofline.
Jeff Robertson is the architect.
It's a true timber frame with peg joints and hand-cut mortises built by a company out of Port Townsend. We designed it, they built it, brought it here and erected it.
Church member Lael Harrison is getting her first look at the new building. Harrison was born in Juneau, baptized at Holy Trinity, and as a kid, she knew every nook and cranny of the old church.
A lot of the spaces in the old building were sort of dark and dank and a little medieval, and this is bright and light and spacious.
The basic considerations in the beginning was to create warmth with natural local materials. The site being very challenging to get a separation of worship space and community center. So probably the easiest description would be sort of a Victorian Italian hill village. There's a multitude of roofs from the outside defines different shapes, spaces that are happening within.
While 100 years of history went up in flames 3 years ago, so did 100-year-old plumbing and other systems, as well as modern costumes, lighting, and gear for Theater in the Rough, housed in adjoining McPheeters Hall. Built in 1955, McPheeters was the site of everything from wedding receptions to meetings, concerts, plays, even an elections polling place. Church Council President Larry Talley says about 80% of the hall was used for non-church-related activities. Many of those users were consulted in planning the new one.
It costs more to do that, but at the same time, it gives us opportunities to raise funds in different ways. We wouldn't be able to get a Rasmussen grant to build a church, but we may very well be able to get a Rasmussen grant to finish McPheeters Hall because of the history of the kind of use that we've always supported there.
The church has even asked the city for a $150,000 grant for McPheeters. The request is pending before the assembly. Theater in the Rough founder Aaron Elmore helped design the new space. He says the new McPheeters is smaller, but a more useful shape. And the acoustics? Well, in the old McPheeters,
they're horrible. Even in here, even right now, this is better than the old McPheeters Hall was. Almost anyone who uses the hall is going to benefit from the fact that there is a PA system set up, that there is a raised platform. You know, there's a focus to the room. You put out enough tables, you can set people for lunch, but they all know where the speaker's going to end up. They're going to be visible and they're going to be hearable. It's going to improve pretty much everything that goes on in here. Even if you're a kid, you know, 4 feet tall, you're going to be able to sit in the middle of this theater and still be able to see what's going on stage.
Holy Trinity's insurance settlement for the fire is about $3.5 million. Construction of the new sanctuary in McPheeters Hall is nearly $4 million. That leaves more than $1 million to raise through loans, grants, and fundraisers. The Reverend Salidi says the church has brought in about $450,000 to date. Salidi says the building is on schedule and on budget. It's a slow pace,
hoping to raise money ahead of the construction schedule.
Since the fire, church services and other meetings have been held at St. Anne's Parish Hall just a block away. Salidi says the congregation could have waited to start construction when all the money was in the bank, but
rather than taking another 100 years to put together what was in place when it burnt down, we thought we would try to accomplish it in our own lifetime.
After the sanctuary opens, the next phase again depends on funding. Tally says if grants for McPheeters Hall come in, it will be next. Then the kitchen and popular craft shop, the Mustard Seed.
So if we got money to finish this in 2010, could be 2011 before the hammers quit.
In Juneau, I'm Rosemarie Alexander.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Begin your UAF fisheries degree at any major University of Alaska campus and finish in Fairbanks or Juneau. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
The University of Alaska will have to make do on less money than Regents requested from the state for the upcoming fiscal year. The state legislature allocated $326 million to UA for fiscal year 2010 operations. UA Associate Vice President of Budget Michelle Rizik says the operating fund total is about 4% more than last year, but well short of what was requested.
$14.7 million less than the region's request and $2.2 million less than the governor included in her budget.
Rizik says the state support falls $400,000 under the amount needed to cover employee salary and benefits and a total of $4.7 million short of fixed costs.
Specifically to Fairbanks, the lack of utility cost funding will provide some challenges.
There is some one-time funding in the budget for two developing university programs that Regents sought support for. $950,000 is slated for energy programs at the UAF-based Alaska Center for Energy and Power and Cooperative Extension Service. And $922,000 is included for statewide health programs, but the figures are short of university requests. Rizik says another underfunded area is deferred maintenance. The university has an $800 million list of needed upgrades and repairs. She says $3.2 million allocated by the state for maintenance doesn't come close to the $50 million requested.
We have a significant backlog in deferred maintenance, and so without the minimum level of funding, it will be challenging to not see the deferred maintenance backlog continue to grow into the future.
A bright spot in the funding picture is $116 million in federal economic stimulus funding for construction of the UAF Alaska Region Research Vessel. Sheldon Jackson College has graduated its last students. The 130-year-old Sitka institution closed its doors in 2007, but a handful of students were able to complete their degrees through an arrangement with the University of Alaska. The success is bittersweet. With no more students and no more programs, Alaska's oldest educational institution is officially gone. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
The teach-out, as it was called, concluded on March 31st. 13 students left high and dry when Sheldon Jackson suspended its academic program in June of 2007, enrolled in the teach-out. 10 of them finished their SJ degrees at the University of Alaska. On March 31st, Sheldon Jackson lost its accreditation as a college.
And the accreditation was in place simply for the benefit of the students in the teach-out.
And these students, they can consider themselves Sheldon Jackson alumni?
The last of the Sheldon Jackson alumni, yes.
David Harrington is the former Dean of Academic Affairs at Sheldon Jackson College. 30 years ago, he became a nurse and worked his way through graduate school. He's a nurse again now at Sitka Community Hospital. Harrington and Registrar Kathy Newman oversaw the teach-out with the university over the past 2 years. He regards the college now only in the past tense.
That institution is over. I suppose another institution named Sheldon Jackson could come back, but it would have to go through relicensure, reaccreditation, and certainly the obstacles in terms of getting faculty, staff, and most of all the infrastructure in place is... I think insurmountable.
They would indeed have to submit a new application as if they were a new institution.
Stephanie Butler is the Director of Operations for the Alaska Commission on Postsecondary Education. The loss of accreditation and the loss of its authorization to operate from the state represent the official end of existence for the college. Although Sheldon Jackson is deeply in debt, this is not an academic version of bankruptcy. The school will not pick itself up and dust itself off and soldier on. Sandra Ellman is president of the Northwest Commission on Colleges and Universities, the organization that accredits schools in this region. She visited SJ several times since 1997 and observed firsthand SJ's slow spiral. Ellman says March 31st carried a sense of finality for the school, but also a sense of hope.
There is certainly a period at the end of the sentence, so to speak, and there is a closing to the book of Sheldon Jackson College, but that doesn't mean that there may not be a new book with a new title and a new set of circumstances.
On one of her last visits to SJ in 2007, before the college closed, Ellman got the sense that students were well served, but there simply weren't the resources to move forward. Nevertheless, she feels that there is promise for the future.
Sheldon Jackson College is sitting in probably one of the most beautiful parts of the country. It's sitting in an area in which one could have programs that build upon the environmental context in which Sheldon Jackson was located, with fisheries, with environmental studies, with wildlife, with just a whole range of programs.
The Sheldon Jackson campus was closed, and over 100 faculty and staff were laid off on 24 hours' notice in June of 2007. An unsigned form letter from the Board of Trustees thanking staff for their service circulated in town. In some ways, it symbolized the disconnect that remains today over what Sheldon Jackson was and what it has become. David Harrington.
When the closure occurred, there were lots of conversations, and there was a lot of anger about the fact that the people who were majorly involved in running the college were not involved in the conversations about keeping the college going or how to get the college going.
Harrington says the current economy may stand between the trustees and their plans to convey the campus intact to some entity that will revive it. And he says it is a pity. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
For the past few years, the U.S. Forest Service has been investigating the cause of a massive die-off of alders across much of Alaska, stretching from Nome down to Skagway. For member station KDLG, Mike Mason has the story.
The alder die-off was the topic of a presentation last month by Lori Trummer. She's the retiring Forest Service pathologist who played a lead role in the ongoing investigation. She says the first inkling of the die-off occurred in 2003 in the Lazy Mountain area of the Matsu Valley, when she received a call from a man who had been pushed from agency to agency.
Alders are one of those things that
people don't want. They're normally getting rid of it, or that's where the bears hide. They're avoiding it. You know, for some reason, they're not concerned about the alder. In fact, if there was a biocide that could get rid of alder, I could make a fortune, and I might have one here. But what happens is this poor guy just wasn't getting any traction on it. And I really thank people who have a lot of curiosity, where they can bring an issue forth before anyone sees it. And you'll see how dramatic it is now. But in 2003, all we had was a couple dead alder up near Lazy Mountain.
Drummer says her initial look around the Lazy Mountain site found alders that were dead in 1 year, which is something she had never seen before in her 20 years with the Forest Service.
I found this bark that was kind of pimpled, and when I scraped underneath it, it was completely dead, suggesting that something was working, something infected and worked very fast on these trees and was really pretty efficient at killing these alders.
The alder die-off reported to Trummer in 2003 led to a full-scale investigation of what was killing alders throughout South Central and Interior Alaska. Subsequent alder die-offs have been reported in Colorado and in parts of Western Canada. One of the tools used in the Alaska investigation was 26 monitoring plots located in the Matsu region, Interior Alaska, and on the Kenai Peninsula. Those plots confirm a continuing alder die-off, especially in the Matsu Valley. Trummer reported that in the monitored plots, only 32% of the alder stems are considered healthy, with the rest characterized as dead or dying back. Another part of the investigation was the identification of over 12 native canker pathogens that seem to be impacting alders. Trummer says the pathogens are likely native to Alaska.
It's curious to us that these things that are native, and sure, we can have outbreaks, but not like this. Some of the researchers that we're working with at University of Alaska Fairbanks have considered this unprecedented, this amount of dieback in our thin-leafed alder.
Trummer says the die-off of the alders is also apparently tied to insect infestations and other environmental factors like seasonal drought stress between the summers of 2003 and 2006, which she characterized as unseasonably warm.
And in those years, that's when we started seeing these things really flare up. We saw the cinerea moth flare up in southwest Alaska for between 2000 and 2006. We saw these native canker pathogens really get started during that time. This is around, I guess, 2003 or 2004, and that's when that call from Lazy Mountain came in.
The Forest Service is continuing to investigate the cause of the alder die-off in Alaska, which Trummer believes is linked to global warming and above-normal temperatures in recent years. At present, there are over 10 different studies underway on Alaska's alders in an effort to better understand the causes of the die-off and its impact on the larger environment. Trummer speculated that we have not yet seen the maximum proportion of plants affected or dead in the state.
Worst case scenario, in some places, alders might be no longer part of the ecosystem or might be a much smaller component of the ecosystem, but we're not going to lose our alders in Alaska. I don't think we ever could.
I'm Mike Mason.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from John Hunt in Haines, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Rosemarie Alexander in Juneau, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, and Mike Mason in Dillingham. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Grant Station, now offering several webinars each month. More information at grantstation.com. And by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.